Welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastors Bob Thune and Dusty White of Corumbeo Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the philosophy of transgenderism.
We wanted to devote a podcast or two to the topic of transgenderism. And here's why. Here's what motivates me pastorally in this podcast. There's a sense from a lot of Christians. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff coming down the pike right now in terms of federal mandates, like the transgender restroom thing that happened a few weeks ago. And a lot of Christians seem to be having sort of a passive response that says, hey, let's not freak out about this. You know, it's not a big deal. And we should sort of just be, you know, we shouldn't be alarmist about it. We shouldn't be scared or nervous or freaked out. This really isn't that big of a deal. I agree. Let's not be scared, nervous, or freaked out. I want to change the way you think about this and help you see that transgenderism, and specifically the way that legal discourse is moving around the topic of transgenderism, is a much bigger deal than most Christians give it credit for, and that it's something dramatically different than the issue of homosexuality. So even though we, you know, in modern culture, GLBT sort of all gets lumped together, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, those are sort of all seen as one sort of grouping. We want to think about why transgenderism is actually something quite different from homosexuality and what the dangers of that are. Because, I think that in our reaction to sort of being overly alarmist, many of us who are sort of cynical and learn to see through things and have sort of a jaded view of anybody who says anything is a huge deal, anytime we sort of sense that people are being alarmist about something, there's something that rises up in us where we want to go, oh, it's not that big. It's not as big a deal as those people are making it out to be. However, I think in this case, what the transgender lobby is saying about human personhood has deep, deep implications. And as Christians, we have a responsibility to stand against that ideology. While we love and appreciate and reach out to people who would identify as transgendered, we need to argue against the ideology that lies underneath sort of the transgender movement and many of the legal arguments that are being made. So let's review some basic categories that we've talked about before on the podcast. When we talk about sex, we're talking about male or female, the biological design that our bodies have as people made in the image of God and made male or female. When we talk about gender, we're talking about more the sort of social, psychological, dispositional aspects that we might use the terms masculinity or femininity to apply to. So there's you're male or female in your biology, you are masculine or feminine in your gender, or there are roles perhaps in society that are associated with genders. What is happening in the transgender movement, and if you read the legal scholarship here, it's very clear that this is the move that's being made, is to say that gender eclipses sexuality. That we are not sexed beings. In fact, there is no such thing as sex. There's only gender. And our gender is chosen by us. And so we can choose to be male or female. I can choose to identify as male or female. And that the reason that transgenderism is sort of driving this agenda is obviously because if I'm a man biologically who identifies as a woman, then the law, in order to give me freedom to use a women's bathroom, even though I don't have women's body parts, has to say that I can define myself legally as a woman, that my choosing to identify as a woman is itself a statement that I am that. And so the laws are moving away from sexed and embodied physicality and toward simply a politics of identity where I say, well, I identify as a woman, therefore I am one. A lot of feminist legal scholars are having a significant problem with this. Here's why. Because the whole push of feminism is to work against discrimination that's been placed upon women because they're women. So, for instance, if you think about like equal pay in the workplace, right? Why should a woman doing the same job as a man's doing get paid less if she's an equal level of competence doing the same job in the same way? And so feminists have always pushed that being a woman physically should not subject me to some sort of discrimination. Well, if you take away the category of being a physical woman, now you take away that entire foundation of that argument. And so there are actually quite a few in the feminist community who are starting to push back against the transgender erasing of sex distinctions. And guys, we came across an article recently from the Public Discourse, which is a think tank. The title is "A De-Sexed Society is a Dehumanized Society." And essentially what the author is saying is if you take away sex distinctions, you take away humanity. You've dehumanized us because everything about sex has to do with who we are in our physical body. And so if we have to transition into non-sexed beings, if we have to pretend that we are non-sexed beings, if the legal dialogue moves us in the direction of being non-sexed beings, it's dehumanized us. And this is a really, really significant philosophical move. It's rooted in a long philosophical tradition that we'll talk about perhaps in a few minutes. But it's very important for Christians, because of our understanding of what it means to be made in the image of God, that we not embrace the argument that we are simply what we choose, that our identity is what we decide it is, but that we maintain the reality that we, every one of us comes into this world, male or female, that men and women are different, that they have different body parts, different functions, different aptitudes and abilities in terms of how they're made. A woman can carry a baby, a man can't, and therefore that we hold firmly to those distinctions in a culture that increasingly is going to push against those distinctions and try to move us in the direction of an entirely fluid identity based on whatever we choose to identify as.
So, Bob, here's a question for you. Has, in some ways, the church and even sort of more modern evangelical thought made this in some ways easier because we have so emphasized the spiritual, the internal. So in a sense that the real me is not my physical body. It's who I am inside. It's what's going on internally in my mind and in my heart. Because one of the things I've talked with several evangelicals that I know that are sympathetic to this because they consistently locate the core of identity internally. And so what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking, what I'm experiencing inside is the real me. And if that is different than what I am present in my body, then what trumps? What sort of anchors me in truth and reality? Well, it's the spiritual side. It's the immaterial side, because that's really me, right?
I think evangelicalism has long sort of been guilty of a little bit of a proto-Gnosticism that would say, you know, the spiritual you is the real you. And it tends to disconnect a little bit body and soul. And we've talked about that before on the podcast. And I think you're right that, no evangelical is going to say, oh, this is where I was expecting that to go, right? We're not doing that intentionally as a way of disconnecting us from our bodily identity. But I do think I would say the antidote in light of what you're saying, Chris, is a return to a robust biblical anthropology that sees us as body and soul united together, not that your body is just a prison house for the soul, you know, and not that the body is sort of just unimportant, but that you are body and soul brought together in one being, and that's a sexed being. You're either male or female. You're a man or a woman, and that's by God's design. Here's where there... Again, I want Christians to be aware of what's going to happen here. And this isn't me saying this. These are some legal scholars that I've been reading who are sort of reading the tea leaves on where this is going. And they would argue, and I see their point and would tend to agree with them, that the whole movement of transgenderism is rooted in a very particular social understanding that seeks to do away with the family. And so if you can get rid of the importance of male and female, if you can get rid of the fact that a family depends on a mother and a father, if you can get rid of biology at all as a defining characteristic of personhood, then what you have is the erasing of the family. So my family is now whoever I choose to identify as my family, which puts the state in a very powerful place, because the state can now define who your parents are. The state can say, we'll talk about your legal guardian. We're not going to use the terms mother and father, because those are sexed and gendered terms. So instead of having a mother and a father, you have legal guardians. And you can see how this begins to erase any real distinguishing characteristics of what makes me or what makes my family what it is biologically. And I think there are really dangerous implications here for where this could to take us in terms of society, because we basically get rid of the autonomy, the authority, the primacy of the family unit, and the family would be whatever the state allows it to be.
This makes sense to me in one way, that one of the things I've been wrestling with is why such intensity toward a group that really statistically is small. Like there's not, you know, I think we deal with issues of racism and sexism, even with, you know, homosexuality, that statistical numbers are at least much higher than the transgender issue. And this makes sense to me. It comes down to an issue of authority. This is another way that culturally can get inside and exercise control, especially over a conservative or Christian ethic, and really trying to just wipe all vestiges, influence from society. And this is another vehicle to do it.
And so Christians need to be aware of that. American Christians need to be aware of the fact that we're in the midst of a battle that's not about who gets to use the bathrooms at Target. It's about much more foundationally, who are we, and what does it mean to be people in society? Vanita Gupta is the acting head of the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice. She stated this month that transgendered women are women and transgendered men are men. In other words, that they don't just identify as, but are metaphysically women and men, which is a radical statement. And you realize this is the Department of Justice saying this. This is your United States government. These are the people that are in charge of the justice system. This is the acting head of the Civil Rights Division. And so when you get this transgender gender politics coming in the vehicle of civil rights, which I think we all would look at and say, man, civil rights, what a beautiful thing, what a wonderful thing, how good for American society. Now we have really sinister social agendas getting co-opting that sort of division of the Justice Department and pushing downstream. And this is going to increasingly be a problem for Christians. We're going to increasingly face ostracism, rejection, and marginalization because of our unwillingness here to cave on male and female, manhood and womanhood not being fluid categories.
You guys are saying there's an agenda here that is being pushed and rolled out, but transgendered folks have been around for more than just the last couple months. And so how did we get here? Like, who said, oh, we're gonna latch on to this small group of people and push our agenda with that?
Gosh, I don't know. And you know, like, that's...
It seems like the Illuminati or something. It just seems like a big conspiracy.
Well, and that's
theory.
The danger of saying it's an agenda is like, well, who's behind it? Well, kind of every... This is the funny thing about culture, and James Davison Hunter makes this point well, that culture is more amorphous and more sort of polyvalent and more, you know, bigger than we can get our hands on. But there is something where when you get government departments, media elites, and influential people in society pushing in the same direction, that there is a net effect that has. And I think that's the answer. You see this transgender push. Who knows where it came from? I think it's probably just all a fruit of the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. You know, obviously it started with feminism, and there are aspects of feminism that are good, aspects of feminism that aren't so good. Then you had sort of the homosexual rights movement in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. And then I think transgenderism is sort of just the next wave of that whole movement saying that if we are redefining what sexuality is, if we're removing the norms and the mores of sexuality, then why don't we go all the way? Mm-hmm. And see, the danger of this is once you go down that track, it really is a slippery slope. There's no way to not go all the way, because once you start disconnecting role in society from sexuality or norms in society sexually, once you start undoing that, it's hard to say, well, that should stop here. Mm-hmm. You know, that needs to end in this spot. And yet, common sense would say it has to, right? Sex is part of who we are. There's a British philosopher who makes this point. He says, if we were to take away John's hands, we would be left with somebody. But to take away John's sex, we would need to take away the whole of his body, which would leave nobody. Sex is neither a part of the body nor a property of the body. Sex is the name we use to point toward that thing which the body itself is constituted of. So there's this deep essentialism to our sexuality that we can't get beyond, but that that again, I can geek out philosophically here and maybe will, but there's a whole sort of philosophical underpinning to this understanding that really goes all the way back to the Enlightenment that we're just sort of reaping the fruit of.
Yeah.
This is kind of where things go.
So let me piggyback on that and kind of insert the language aspect here. Yesterday I was downtown having lunch with a guy from church, and we saw this guy with a t-shirt on that said, pronouns, they matter, and had these different male, female symbols. And it was a little ambiguous what it was supporting, but it was some sort of message about language tied to identity. And so, Bob, as you were referring to kind of the Enlightenment and the influence of that, moving through sort of the child of the Enlightenment, I think really in some ways, the end of the Enlightenment, you get into postmodernism and the way postmodernism treated language, where it tried to detach grammar and language from that essentialism, that there is an absolute objective truth that language is referencing. It's pointing back to. And so the guy that is sort of the father of this deconstruction, you have guys like Foucault and then Derrida who really tried to work to undo language, that there is no absolutes. So language is essentially a will to power, kind of falling off of Nietzsche. So if my definition and your definition don't jive, who has the most power in culture? Who has the ability to define terms? And that's what we see here. So why do pronouns matter? Why does the language of law matter? Because in essence, if we don't believe language is referring to what's objectively true, then we're left with anybody can define reality. And there's a really interesting, I was reading an article about Derrida here recently, which says a lot about my
no one else listening to this podcast was doing that.
So this article points to how Derrida and his sort of philosophical program pointed out that as long as we believe in a grammar, that in essence, we will continue to believe in God. And so to undermine grammar, undermine language as referring to objective reality, ultimately the end of that is to kill God. And so that, again, why should Christians care about language? Well, if you read the philosophers that are trying to undermine language, what's their ultimate agenda? Completely destroy the authority of God.
Well, and it's an intelligent connection, right? Because as Christians, we believe that God revealed his truth to us in language. Right? Like we have the scriptures and we have the word of God made flesh, and these are God revealing himself in word and in language. In fact, if you think all the way back to the story of the Tower of Babel, how did God judge humanity? By confusing their language, because language is so deeply a part of how God has made us to understand the world and understand him. So there's a deep connection between the language we use and the objective reality of God's existence that can't be erased, and yet that philosophers who are opposed to God's existence or who want to see society move beyond that superstition, there's a reason why language would be a place that they would attack.
And what better way to attack the existence of God than through his image bearers? So if we remove what it means to be human, if we undermine that, then we are attacking the very image of God in us and in a way attacking God. So there's, you know, if you really start to get inside what's happening here, it's much more than just, well, who uses the bathroom? And isn't it, it's okay if some poor transgendered person wants to use the female bathroom or the male bathroom. And in some sense, like, yeah, okay, I don't think they're going to be a threat. And, you know, those kind of things where there's some alarmism, but it's more than that. It's far more than that. And I think we need to be wise in understanding that.
Well, and to go way back in philosophy, the roots of this are there's sort of two different streams in philosophy, and I'll probably highly oversimplify this. And if there's a listener who can provide more nuance, we would welcome you to do that. the streams of nominalism and realism. Okay, realism is the way we use language connects to something that really is there. Okay, so that would sort of be the Christian worldview is a critical realist worldview, which would say, hey, sin corrupts our ability to know what is, but there really is something universal and beyond us, an absolute that language refers to. Nominalism is from the Latin word nom, which means name. And what it means is that a word is just a name that doesn't connect to any essential reality. So apply this to the politics of gender, right? To say that you're a man or that you're a woman is just a name. That doesn't connect to any essential reality that actually is objectively, universally, verifiably, eternally true. It's just a something you've chosen to call yourself, which if man is just something I've chosen to call myself and tomorrow I would like to choose to call myself woman, there's no reason why that wouldn't make sense philosophically. And so these two streams of philosophy have sort of gone back and forth for hundreds of years now. And as you say, Nietzsche fell in the nominalist camp and probably, you know, the more hardcore existential skeptic camp. And Foucault and Derrida and the sort of postmodern philosophers in that strain very much believed that language does not connect to objective reality, but that it is a human tool for power and for manipulation and for various groups to exercise dominance in society. And doggone it, the Christians have had dominance long enough in Western society. It's time to disempower them and empower whoever, right? Whoever we would seek to, whatever group I have that I want to be in power.
Could you say that the fact that we're so confused on what's true and what words mean what, like, is that God's judgment?
Well, yeah, according to Romans 1, it is.
Yeah.
And this gets back to the very temptation of Eve in Genesis 3, where what is the essence of you will be like God? The knowledge of good and evil. What's the
ability to name things.
Yeah, the ability to name
things. Reality.
Yeah. To
make reality. Yeah,
define what is real, what is true, what is good. And that's essentially what we're doing. You will become like gods. Well, that is what we are, the kind of power that our culture is trying to grab.
So to go back to where we began this podcast, here's where I see a really dramatic difference. In the sort of homosexual rights movements, you had gay men and you had lesbian women who were saying, I'm a biological man and I find myself attracted to biological men, or I'm a biological woman and I find myself attracted to biological women. There was a push for redefining the sort of sexual norms and ethics, but there was not a push for redefining what it means to be a man or a woman. Transgenderism seeks to redefine the very nature of manhood and womanhood. And so for that reason, again, though it's lumped under the same sort of broad category of LGBT, it's a very, very different and more sinister thing to drive at the very essence of maleness and femaleness. And so, again, I think now where we're at in society is that many people are jumping on that bandwagon and saying, well, yeah, why should we be worried about gender at all? Gender is entirely a fluid category. However, the beautiful thing about you guys mentioned Romans 1. The beautiful thing about creation, the beautiful thing about being made in the image of God is we can't ignore the bodies that God has given us. We can try to. We can suppress the truth and unrighteousness. We can avoid the implications of those things. But the beautiful thing is nature does speak to us. The way God has made the world does say something about how the world is. And so as Christians, we have great strength in standing on that natural law, that natural revelation, that reality of our sexed and gendered bodies, and saying, nope, we're not willing to redefine these things, nor does it even make any sense to do so. We don't need a Christian argument for that even. We can just say, nope, I was born with male body parts, and that makes me a man. Daughter, you were born with female body parts. That makes you a woman, a female.
And those are prescribed.
Yeah, those are different, and they're eternal, and they're lasting. And you can call them whatever you want. That does not make reality. So a quick word to – first a word to Christians, then a word to parents. The word to Christians is just we got to care about this stuff. You need to do some reading on these issues, and you need to be aware that – you know, the transgender stuff is not just about the bathrooms at Target or, you know, the transgender person that you see walking down the street. And do we honor them and consider them a human being made in the image of God? The answer is yes. But this whole agenda brings with it something much more deeply troubling and much more deeply destructive of what it means to be human. And so we need to see that. And that's part of the goal of this podcast, is just opening your eyes to that and recognizing that there's a whole statement being made here about personhood mm-hmm. that we're bound by Scripture to reject. Secondly, a word to parents, and that is just, you got to realize you're raising kids in a world that's very confused about this. And in fact, the world, because it's so confused, and the culture, because it continues to push this, is only going to create more confusion in younger and younger kids. I was reading an article from some sort of cultural commentator who said that in their daughter's sixth grade class, a third of the girls in the class identify as bisexual. And they're just like, look, there's no way a third of the 12-year-olds that go to school with you are bisexual, right? It's just an age of sort of sexual confusion anyway. Nobody really knows. It's sort of the beginning of puberty. But now that the culture says, hey, maybe you're transgender, maybe you're bisexual, maybe you're homosexual, there's just new categories opening up for younger and younger kids. And so your children are going to have to walk a countercultural path in this world in the midst of that, and you're going to need to equip them for that with a robust biblical worldview, with a deep understanding of who they are. You need not be fearful, because if you're raising your kids according to the Bible's worldview, they already know that they're a boy or they're a girl. That's one of the earliest things kids figure out. You don't need to worry that they're going to be confused on that, but you do need to equip them to meaningfully engage with others who more and more are going to have these sorts of confusions and questions. And again, not everybody who identifies as transgender is aware of sort of the deep legal and philosophical arguments underpinning that. So I'm not saying that this is a conversation philosophically that you need to be equipped to have all the time, but the philosophical things we're talking about here are just giving you a backdrop so you can understand why the question of sex and gender is such an important question for Christians in the modern world.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in. And we pray that the things that we've talked about today might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We invite you to join us next Wednesday for another Wednesday Conversation.